Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi. And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of July 17th, 2017. 7-17-17, I like that. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
I want everyone to know that D.R. has a marvelous purple striped tie on. He is a sartorial a masterwork. Mm-hmm. So, D.R., lots of interesting sort of straws in the wind floating around this week. One is a report, and without going into the details in tremendous detail, but there's a report that talks about the fact that a significant fraction of the carbon pollution that is currently in the air can be traced to a limited number of commercial companies dating back to the mid-80s, right? You can count on, you know, on a reasonably short list, the exact people who are driving, responsible for the emission of a lot of carbon dioxide. Did you see that, an article like that, D.R.? I mean, what's the background on that?
Yes, it was an Inside Climate News article about the quote-unquote carbon majors report for the Carbon Disclosure Project, and they basically described the major players in carbon emissions since 1988: Saudi Aramco, Gazprom, National Iranian Oil, ExxonMobil, and the Xinhua Group and Rosneft from our Russian
Rosneft
friends.
Yeah. Okay.
And it just basically sort of goes to show you. Number one, you know, how many of these companies may have internally, we know the Exxon New controversy, how many of them may have internally recognized the risks that they're posing to the planet. And number two, the political influence that Exxon and others have exerted to basically confuse the issue. And as I saw this piece, I thought back to, I think it was the Comer, I want to say it was the Comer Oil, I think it was Comer Oil versus Murphy case. That was the case where victims of Hurricane Katrina had sued to try to hold the fossil fuel industry responsible for the emissions that had caused climate change. And the courts in that case, if I remember correctly, basically said, well, you can't hold these specific fossil fuel companies responsible, because what about all those polluters since the days of the Industrial Revolution? So you just wonder if the public confusion can influence the courts, if there's another case such as Comer Murphy versus Comer Oil or Kivalina versus ExxonMobil, and these companies will avoid any sort of legal responsibility because people will say, well, what about all the pollution that occurred before 1988?
And I guess that's a good segue, because I think one of the interesting things about this report that I take is a perspective on the process that we're going through. And I'm going to try and slow down and say it carefully, because I don't have a blackboard in front of me. It's much easier if I could just draw a graph, right? But you're quite right. Up to 1988. Let me start again. There's two different questions here. There's the amount of emissions that are released each year. Right, that's a rate of emission, right? Gigatons per year we put into the atmosphere, right? There's a second concept that we have to keep track of, is how much, what is the stock, what is the, how much carbon dioxide is there in the atmosphere at any given time? And I guess a simple distinction is you say, I have a savings rate, I put $10 a month in the bank, right? That's a completely different number from how much money do you have in the bank, which could be, $100 or $1 million. The rate of addition is different from the stock. And I think it's important to keep in mind that from the beginning of the Industrial Revolution up to, let's say, 1988, there's X amount of pollution that has been added by the Model Ts and people burning wood to stay warm and that kind of stuff. But since 1988, there's a huge, we've essentially added like a huge amount of pollution since the time we knew about it and that knew about global warming. And that pollution can be attributed to these 100 companies. And further, again, it's just kind of the scale thing, is that these 100 companies are going to continue to give us stuff to burn, right? But that the total amount of carbon dioxide in the air will essentially double in the next 30 years if we keep burning at this rate. So it's kind of like saying, all right, well, you know, I'm putting $10, you know, I've got $1 million in the bank, right? And all of a sudden, 30 years later, you have $2 million, right? You've doubled the stock. And that's very clearly attributed to these specific companies, right? You can trace all to those guys. So I agree with you on a class action suit. It's a little bit shaky to say, you know, to make that attribution of saying, although the preponderance of evidence says the big increase in carbon dioxide stock in the atmosphere is due to the actions of these companies, you know, trying to retard the growth of a different technology.
And also there's also the sort of the court of public opinion, because, you know, there is that mentality out there, and we often hear it in these discussions about Exxon support for a carbon tax, where people will say, well, it doesn't matter what Exxon did back in the day. They're responsible now. They want a carbon tax. It doesn't matter if Shell was, you know, involved in ALEC and some of these other disinformation groups, because now Shell is saying they want to spend as much as $1 billion a year on clean energy. So, you know, the idea that these guys can get a pass on past negative behavior because they're willing to sort of espouse positive virtues today.
Well, and I think to follow your point, I think the more, you know, another, so this is an interesting sort of factoid, this 100 companies kind of thing, is because now you have a very specific limited set of people to name and shame, right? Mm-hmm. To really call these people out. I think McKibben's effort to make Exxon the bad guy, right, allows a kind of psychological coherence on the part of the opposition, right? Now you have these 100 companies that have done all this damage recently, since we knew about it, and have fought to have that pollution reduced, and are perfectly willing to go ahead and double the amount of carbon dioxide that's in the air by continuing to burn it and oppose any kind of oppose anything. And those guys need to be clearly called out. So I think the name and shame thing is another powerful factor in why this is an interesting article.
Exactly, but the problem is that we're dealing with people who, even if they're named and shamed, do they suffer any sort of accountability? I mean, Mr.
Only
Tillerson,
when they, he moved on divested.
I mean, George Jefferson wishes he could move on up the way Rex Tillerson did.
Yeah, well, okay, I mean, Rex Tillerson, that's a whole other rant. I mean, how many hours do you have, DR? I'll tell you what I think.
I mean, talk about
Rex
finally
Tillerson.
Getting a piece of the pie. He ate the whole damn pie.
Well, I guess the other kind of news that people need to know about, people in general, I mean, our listeners who should be aware of these things, because it always comes down to particulars. And even here in Massachusetts, we've been debating about solar installations, right? So the solar panels, photovoltaic power, has been great. Everyone in Massachusetts, you can see the stuff everywhere now. It's been a good thing. There have been debates in the legislature about limitations on the support for the photovoltaic industry, the solar panel industry. But there was a very interesting article in the New York Times saying that there is now a concerted effort nationwide by utilities in their industrial organizations to basically try and break the back of the growth of solar panels on people's roof. Right, DR? Did you see that?
Yes, there's a great piece in the New York Times about essentially this effort to sell out solar, so to speak. This sort of renewed effort, obviously, in the wake of the outcome of the last presidential election on a state level to sort of kill off solar, to make sure that solar is taxed, to make it damn near impossible to get solar on your roof. And again, you know, every action results in equal and opposite reaction. You do wonder if this will galvanize more and more people to push back against this sort of stuff on a state and local level where these battles are fought and where these battles have to be won in terms of putting a stop to this nonsense.
Well, and I think that the way that people can push back is by having knowledge. And so the argument of the utility is the following, I'll dig up the we put up a podcast almost a year ago on this topic, but the argument of the utility, people like NSTAR, right, they say that the guy who has the solar panel on his roof, or the gal, right, whoever has the solar panel on their roof is freeloading on the system, because they take advantage of the transmission lines that bring power to their house or take power away from their house, and they don't have to pay for it. And so the guy next door, who doesn't have the solar panel on his roof, needs to pay more in order to have these solar panels in the system. And I think that's the kind of divisive, polarizing argument that somehow pits people against each other, right? To say, oh, that your neighbor is cheating you by having those solar panels on. That's very divisive. And the argument that we have made, and I think is the true argument, is that solar panels on your neighbor's roof ensure cheaper electricity costs for everyone, improve the system reliability, and are a net benefit to the whole system. And I think that people knowing that, just that fact, allows you to sort of mitigate this idea that, you know, Joe Schmo up the street's taking advantage of me, right? I mean, that's the whole argument. You know, the whole sort of conservative argument is pointing to villains who are hiding behind the tree, stealing your money, right? So, I don't know. What do you think, DR?
And also the idea of attacking this is to attack the concept of a greater good, to say that there's no such thing as a greater societal good by such things as solar panels. It's really sleazy, sleazy stuff. But again, you know, the people against this stuff, they're organizing, and for now they're winning, and now it's time to do some reverse organizing and reverse winning.
Well, so that's an interesting point. We can't talk about it now, but there's an article about a guy named James Buchanan, right, who's this sort of libertarian economist who won a Nobel Prize, yada, yada. But within that article, I mean, the article purports, the discussion of this guy purports to explain the philosophy of conservatism. But one of the arguments that Buchanan made, I guess, in the 1950s, was that politicians should not be viewed as serving the public good. They should be viewed as independent actors trying to maximize their own personal gain by being in the public sphere. Right. And that is the root accusation now of every politician, that every politician is just out to make their own money and stay in office and have power. That is a personal thing. And I think that sort of argument, saying things like that, speaks directly to the idea of the common good, that we're all doing things to, you know, we have solar panels because it's good for everybody. And I think that this attack on the solar panels by the utilities falls out of this reprehensible philosophy of you know, absolute free market fundamentalism, and in fact the dominance of the market over the individual. We're going to talk about these guys at some point. We're all three of us get together and talk about Mr. Buchanan.
Was it John Kenneth Galbraith who talked about how people like Mr. Buchanan try to find the virtue in selfishness?
Yeah, I mean, what is the guy, Mr. Gecko from the movie, saying, you know, greed is good. Right? Greed makes everything happen. Well, okay, maybe, but...
It goes to the argument, I think we've discussed this before, the people who say that Oliver Stone never should have made that movie because he should have realized that people would not see the Gecko character as the villain, but the hero. They'd perceive him to be the hero.
I guess the other thing, the last topic I wanted to touch on, DR, was the was a sort of an uplifting thing. This recently, this past weekend, was the celebration of the 200th, get that, 200th anniversary of the birth of Henry David Thoreau. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, for those of you, I mean, I tried to read Thoreau as a kid, and it's very hard. His language is very sort of stultified, but actually pretty interesting. But Thoreau came from the Boston area, right? He's world famous now, but he came from the Boston area. Lots of philosophy. He's most famous for living at a place called Walden Pond, which is right now just off Route 128 on Route 126 up there. You can zoom by it. It's a state park. Have you ever been to Walden Pond, DR?
I've never been there, but it's great to see, you know, Mr. Thoreau being honored, and I would say it's a good thing. Good thing he wasn't around when Fox. Good thing Fox News wasn't around back then, because you can imagine what they would have said about him.
Well, I have been there a couple of times, and the Thoreau cabin is remarkable. Maybe at some point in the future we can have Mariah Tinker come back on and talk to us about Thoreau. But being there, but you go there, and there's all this talk about Thoreau's cabin, and he wanted to live in the woods and all that kind of stuff. This cabin is this little tiny, literally like 8 foot by 10 foot, with a little cot in it. It is not. It's set overlooking Walden Pond. It is just idyllic and beautiful, and so beautiful. I guess it's kind of like, put it this way. Miles Davis's Kind of Blue album is so fantastic, because it set a definition of what music should be, right? So it's time. Mm-hmm. Where in Thoreau's, this little cabin overlooking the lake set this definition of what you think, you know, is the right way to live your life. And it's just, it's gorgeous. But the other interesting thing from a climate change perspective is that Thoreau was quite the documentarian scientist guy. He wrote down when certain plants came out, when the ice thawed out, all that kind of stuff. And that is currently being used as a check of the shift in spring of weather patterns, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I was thinking to myself, you know, they've made this new cable series about William Shakespeare. Why don't they do a new cable series about Thoreau and his life, and sort of examine that?
We're going to do that. We could have our own reenactment. We could have a dramatic reading of Walden Pond. Well, there's a I guess our hero Bill McKibben has just put out some sort of a new copy of Walden Pond with a foreword in it. So it's all very climate relevant, right? Henry David Thoreau, on many, many, many levels, you can't retroactively claim a climate hawk. But I think that if Thoreau was with us today, we'd like to interview him for this podcast, right?
Definitely.
All right, so we got to stop there, DR. Let me tell everyone that we'll put up a few links here on the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. Of course, you can find us on the Facebook page at Mass Climate Action. If you like, send us a notification there. Again, if the technical quality of the podcast goes up and down, let us know. We desperately want it to sound good for you. If there are topics you want to hear about, let us know. We're here to be interesting. You can listen to this podcast directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, and you can find us on iTunes. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So, DR, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
Thanks to all of you for listening. I want you to go and suck the very marrow out of your life and take advantage of your opportunity. If you get a chance to go to Walden Pond, do so. See you all later. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us, and until next time, be green.
Very cool.